Facebook is ready to go public,
but it'll need Wall Street's help.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, February 1st.
Coming up, Wall Street gets held to account by federal prosecutors.
We'll have a conversation with the new head of JCPenney.
And should you mow your neighbor's lawn to keep your own home's value from falling?
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Facebook is expected to file paperwork as soon as today to sell stock to the public. The company has reportedly picked the Wall Street investment bank Morgan Stanley to lead its initial public offering. Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore joins us now to talk about Wall Street's role in the Facebook IPO. Good morning, Heidi.
Good morning.
So, Heidi, why does Facebook need these Wall Street firms in order to make this IPO happen?
Going public just means Facebook is going to sell its stock to the public for the first time to raise money. And to raise the most money, they need to reach the most people. Investment banks spend all day selling stock to people. So they know everyone who wants to buy stock. They have these really big, thick Rolodexes. I talked to Brett Paskey. He is an investment banker, the head of equity capital markets for William Blair, and he explained very simply what he does.
We have a seller of stock and we have a buyer of stock, and we're the ones making a marketplace between those two parties.
So investment banks also find out everything that's going to go wrong with Facebook or other companies, and they tell investors that. They run interference for the company.
And what do they get out of this situation?
In one word, really big fees. All right, that's three words. But if Facebook is going to sell something like $10 billion of stock, it's probably going to give around 7% of that to the banks as fees, and that's a pretty big payday.
And what if I, as an individual investor, don't want to go through this bank situation and just want to go to my E-Trade or Ameritrade account and buy the Facebook stock as soon as it goes public? Do I get the same deal?
No, you wouldn't. As with so much in life, you would need connections. So you'd have to wait until Facebook officially went public and its stock was trading on the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ, and you'd end up paying a lot more.
Marketplace New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore. Heidi, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Now to another tech story of the day. Amazon's shares are fizzling. That's after the company forecast it might lose money in the first few months of the year. Turns out some of Amazon's trouble actually has to do with the successes of its Kindle e-readers. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins explains.
Amazon couldn't sell Kindles fast enough this holiday. The company says its e-reader sales tripled from a year ago. So why are profits dropping? Tech consultant Tim Beharin says blame Amazon's newest device, the Kindle Fire.
They sell it actually at a loss.
Beharin estimates the Kindle's components cost $202. The company sells it for $199. Beharin says Amazon needs the Kindle to stay competitive. It's a tool to sell movies, books, music, all, of course, through Amazon.
I actually think in the long term, it's still a very smart move. But it's not one that pays off immediately.
Or even in the near future. Amazon says next quarter it may report a loss. But it'd be hard to tell that listening to Amazon's chief financial officer, Tom Skutak, in a conference call with analysts.
You know, we see a lot of opportunity in front of us. And yes, there's, you know, some pockets of softness.
Softness. That's business speak for things that aren't so much on fire. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
The government is expected to file criminal charges today against two former traders at Credit Suisse for allegedly misstating the value of mortgage bonds back in 2008. In fact, one of those traders turned himself in to authorities in Manhattan this morning. It would be one of the first and most important criminal cases related to banks that helped cause the financial crisis, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
It's become a familiar accusation that during the housing crisis, banks packaged shaky mortgages into securities and sold them to investors at inflated prices. Hillary Sale teaches law at Washington University in St. Louis. She says traders had ample reason to push these investments.
Individuals' bonuses would have been based to some extent on actually completion of these trades. And then there was just the incentive to get them off the books and out.
Very few people have been charged so far, and few cases have been brought. Why has it taken so long? Carl Tobias is a law professor at the University of Richmond.
There is difficulty having any kind of cooperation And, of course, the government wants to be absolutely certain that it has a rock-solid case.
Think of prosecutors as detectives. They have to understand these investments, sift through them, and then try to explain them to a jury. The only other time federal prosecutors argued a case like this, in 2009, they lost. Two Bear Stearns traders were found not guilty. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Well, for more on this story, let's bring in Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, who joins us from New York, as he does every Wednesday. Good morning.
Hi, Jeremy. How are you?
Doing very well. So why has it taken so long for the government to hold people accountable?
The wheels of justice move, move very slowly. I think the pace is now speeding up because Obama has figured out a triangulation here. What the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street movement both have in common is they're both disgusted with the fact that there have been no prosecutions. So this is actually a really smart move heading into the election. But I think it's about more than that. A lot of the stuff that's gone on has actually taken this long to figure out.
And what's the precedent for that? I mean, if you go back to the Great Depression, if we look back to that, how long did it take for prosecutions to take place?
You know, that's really the most interesting aspect of it. People assume that 4 years have passed and the statute of limitations, and so forget it. But if you look at the Pecora Commission, Pecora generated thousands of pages of wrongdoing and things of that nature about 4 years after the actual crash of 29. And what we got as a result of that provided about 50 years of relative financial stability. We got Glass-Steagall. We got the Securities Act of 33, Securities Act of 34. So I think that that's really interesting that something that important can happen so far after the fact.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. Thanks as always, Josh.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Leading up to last night's victory in Florida, Mitt Romney and his allies outspent Newt Gingrich and his allies by a margin of 5-1. Now, when I say allies, I'm talking about these super PACs, the independent groups that are allowed to spend unlimited cash as long as they reveal where the money's coming from. But as our Washington bureau chief John Dimsdale reports, following the money is easier said than done.
Last year, Mitt Romney's super PAC reported a $1 million donation from a company called WSPAN. The trouble is, WSPAN had disappeared, and no one could tell where the money came from. Bill Allison is the editorial director of the Sunlight Foundation, which promotes government transparency. He says some corporations are hard to trace.
Sometimes all you have is the lawyer or accountant who filed the paperwork. You really don't know who the interests are behind it. That's what makes it so difficult to really follow the money in this election.
Eventually, a former colleague of Mitt Romney's from Bain Capital claimed ownership of the $1 million donation.
It's very possible we'll see some more cases of it this time around.
Peter Stone covers money and politics for the Center for Public Integrity.
There are some people out there who are probably a little nervous about being publicly identified with campaigns, and we're going to have to look very hard to see if we can dig up other cases like this.
From now through Election Day, super PACs must disclose their donors every month. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Well, Jeremy, now the contest to be the Republican presidential nominee is headed to Nevada and the Republican caucus this Saturday. Nevada has had a tough time since the housing bust, but Las Vegas is starting to show signs of life again. Today, we continue our special election coverage, The Real Economy, with a look at how Las Vegas's marketing gurus are betting on more than just gamblers. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
When retiree Randa McIntosh comes to Vegas, she heads straight to the slot machines.
It's easy, and we can watch people. Oh, my goodness, we can watch people. It's fun.
But that's not where McIntosh is blowing most of her money. Instead, she and her sister will spend big on two Cirque du Soleil shows, dinners and drinks, and a nice hotel.
It's not about shopping this time.
The big casinos here now get only 38% of their revenue from gambling. After all, there are plenty of other places to roll the dice. Tribal casinos, Atlantic City, Macau.
Yeah, Macau's now the biggest gaming city in the world. They made about $33 billion from casinos last year, so it's about three times what the whole state of Nevada made.
Gaming expert David Schwartz says for many tourists now, Vegas isn't about gambling at all. It's gourmet restaurants, spas, boutiques, nightclubs, and drunken pool parties. Kathy Toll markets the city for the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority. She's luring people in with special events like 72-hour parties celebrating Sports Illustrated swimsuit models. No-brainer, huh, boys?
It's something that only happens here in Las Vegas. You can't find that somewhere else.
And if swimsuit models and showgirls don't pack them in, there's always the mob. This month, the city opens up the Mob Museum. It was still under construction a few weeks ago. Jonathan Ullman's going to run it.
We suggest that it's really for ages 12 and above. And where it gets a little bit graphic, we do note that.
Former Las Vegas Mayor Oscar Goodman.
You saw the movie Casino? Well, I played myself in that, and all those people were my clients in real life.
Says gangsters fascinate everybody.
This is not going to be a glorification of the mob. Look, the battle was between the mob and law enforcement, and you know who won.
Still, it may be the only museum in the world where your kids can stand in a fake police lineup or shoot a simulated Tommy gun. Only in Las Vegas. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
And our coverage from Nevada continues this Friday on Marketplace with Kai Rizdahl. He'll be broadcasting from Las Vegas.
And exciting.
Maybe doing some gambling, although I doubt it. He doesn't seem like the gambling type
to me. He
doesn't. Well, today President Obama is outlining his plans to help homeowners who owe more on their mortgages than the value of their homes. It's a problem that affects almost 30% of Americans, according to a recent survey. And often the problem can be blamed in part on a foreclosed home on your block, which drives down the value of everything. For more, let's bring in LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how big of a problem is this, David?
Well, it's a really big problem because one in every 69 homes had a foreclosure filing last year, and more than 4 million homes have been lost to foreclosures over the last 5 years. Millions of homes in the proximity of foreclosed homes are affected by this. According to one study, the average hit to a home near a foreclosed home is over $7,000 in property value. So you're going to feel it.
Well, what are you supposed to do if you're one of these people who's keeping up with your mortgage payments, but the people next door have been foreclosed on and their house is in disrepair?
Well, the first thing you got to do is find out who owns the home. If it's been foreclosed on, it still has an owner, and that's the bank. And it is the bank's responsibility to maintain that property. Although they've got such a glut of foreclosed homes, a lot of banks kind of, you know, abrogate their responsibilities. Call up a local real estate agent. Find out which bank owns the property. Call the bank. Have your neighbors call the bank. Also, organize a neighborhood watch because empty homes have a habit of drawing thieves, squatters, right, drug dealers, things like that. You want to circle your wagon as a neighborhood and make sure that you're protected.
And if the bank is not responsive or the owner of the home is not responsive, should you go so far as to actually go and take care of the property next door or down the street to try to keep the value of your home up?
You know, that's always the big question. I would say yes, because you're protecting your own investment. You're protecting your asset. So how much is it going to kill you to go over there and mow the lawn on the other property or get your neighbors to take turns doing that? Some people say that you should park your car in the driveway of the empty home to give the impression there's somebody there. Then the real question is, how much further do you go? Do you paint the walls? Do you put up curtains in the windows? I don't know if I'd go that far, but I would definitely take every step that I could in making sure that property didn't look abandoned.
LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. David, thanks as always.
Thank you.
So, Jeremy, if you walk into a JCPenney today, you'll notice something different. There'll be no more special limited doorbuster sales, none of those giant red signs today only, sale, sale, sale. Instead, the company says it's just going to start off with lower prices.
So no sales. They're just going to have the low prices to begin with.
Yeah, no like single day, single hour kind of sales. They're also getting rid of $29.99 dresses and $19.99 shirts in favor of just $30, $20. Prices will all be in round numbers. It seems kind of revolutionary. The pricing strategy is part of a larger plan to remake the brand, being led by the new CEO, Ron Johnson. He came to Penney's after a decade on the retail side at Apple, and we've got him with us now from Dallas. Good morning.
Good morning, Adrienne.
Now, why go this direction, especially when so many of us have been trained to respond and jump at sales?
Most of what we buy every day is bought at everyday price. When we go to Starbucks, we buy coffee. When we go to the Apple store to buy an iPod, that's an everyday price activity. And so our industry in the department store, in competing with itself, has moved to a very promotional strategy. But if you go down to the center of the mall, most of the things are at everyday price. So we think we're kind of just going to where people have preferred to shop, as evidenced by most of the things they buy in their life.
Now, what can you apply from your experience at Apple to JCPenney? What rolls over?
I learned a tremendous amount at Apple working with Steve and the Apple teams. When you treat the customer well, like at Apple, we try to enrich their lives, they respond. You know, people can buy Apple products everywhere, at Amazon, at Target, at Walmart, at Best Buy. But when their purchase really counts, they head down to the Apple store, right? We hope to become America's favorite store in the years ahead by earning their trust in everything we do, from how we price our products to how we present our products, and most importantly, how we serve them in the stores. So we've learned a lot from Apple, but we'll be carving our own trail.
Now, what's interesting is the department store that you're describing sounds a lot like the older department stores of the past that were maybe more full-service, hands-on kind of stores. Is that part of what you have in mind?
Yeah, I think it's rooted in the history of what made department stores great. For most of us at, you know, my age, we grew up when the department store was king of the retail hill, and we all went to the department stores to discover what was new. And if you look at it today, we don't do that. The consumers kind of move from the end of the mall to the middle of the mall, and we're only about 100 feet down the way. We just got to give her a reason to come back down. So it is. It's rooted in the heritage of what made the department store great, but we're going to do it in a very modern way.
Ron Johnson is the CEO of JCPenney. Thanks.
Thank you.
On to the UK, where a former investment banker has had his knighthood revoked. Sir Fred Goodwin, or now Mr. Fred Goodwin, led the Royal Bank of Scotland when it nearly collapsed during the financial crisis in 2008. He joins an inglorious list of people who've had their knighthood taken away by the Queen. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has our story now from London.
Blood-stained dictators like Robert Mugabe, Benito Mussolini and Nicolae Ceausescu have also been stripped of honours conferred by the British Crown. Goodwin got his knighthood for services to banking. He's losing it because his bank had to be bailed out by the British government with $70 billion. Goodwin's demotion seems popular with the people, but Simon Walker, a spokesman for company directors, said it was unconstitutional.
There's a well-established practice where if people are convicted of a criminal offence, they lose the honours that they've been granted, and that's historic and that is appropriate. To do it because you don't approve of someone, I think, politicises the whole honours system.
Other critics ask, where will this witch hunt against bankers end? There are numerous other bankers with knighthoods that had a hand in the crisis. And what about the man who received his honorary knighthood for services to central banking? Former Fed chairman Alan Greenspan. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming soon to a movie theater near you, Candyland, the classic little kid board game, which is closer to becoming a movie. Reports are out that Adam Sandler might sign on to a romp through the gumdrop mountains and lollipop woods. If Candyland does get made, Adrian, it's going to be the latest, not the first, but the latest board game turned into a movie. There's obviously Clue, great movie. Battleship is due to come out in May.
So in today's Midday Extra, we wanted to find out why board games are shaping up to be the next big trend in Hollywood, if they are. Here to talk with us is Joshua Weinstein, who's been following the story for TheWrap.com. Hey, Joshua.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm well. So how is this deal shaping up?
It's shaping up to be a reasonably big movie over at Sony, and I can tell you why. Three syllables, and they are Transformers. The Transformers movie is based on a toy. It's based on a Hasbro toy, and it's done ridiculously well.
And I know that one of the things that these studios like about these movies that are based on toys is, like, for instance, with the movie Cars, that they can then go out and sell every kid in America the toys that go along with the movie. Is that at play here? I mean, if you come out with a Candyland movie, do they expect the sales of Candyland to go way up?
Well, I think, of course, they do. But I think it's a little bit the other way around. I think Cars was a movie that made toys. You have Candyland, which is a toy being made into a movie.
Now, I have a question. How do you make a game like Candyland, which does not have much of a plot, into a movie that actually is interesting?
Well, let's take a look. Stretch Armstrong doesn't have much of a plot, and it's being made into a movie over Relativity. Battleship is being made into a movie, and Ouija was to be a movie. We still don't know what's going to happen with that. With Candyland, you do, and I'm going to giggle because I'm going to have to say Peppermint Forest and Gumdrop Mountains and Lollipop Woods. But here's what it is. It's intellectual property. So there's this thing out there that people have already heard of, And so the studios are happy because people are going to know the name. Now, you're worried about the plot, so am I, but there are characters already in the game. There's Princess Frostine, there's Lord Licorice, King Candy, and who could forget Mr. Mint?
Mr. Mint. Now, let me ask you one other thing. I mean, it's been a year of movies that at least in the Oscar nominations, that have nothing to do with board games. They're not the ones winning those prizes. But it's also been a year in which not a lot of people have seen movies. Is this the way forward for Hollywood? Is going after something that's recognizable, even if it doesn't have much of a plot, is that the way they're going to start making money again?
Well, look, everybody wants a couple of things. Everybody wants something that people already know and something that people are going to go to. Everybody wants Harry Potter again. Everybody wants Twilight again. And so they're looking for that kind of thing. If that happens to be with board games and toys, that's terrific. This started some years back with a deal that Hasbro made for Universal to make a bunch of movies. But I got to tell you, Universal Studios has chosen not to make a few of the toy movies that it was going to.
Joshua Weinstein from TheWrap.com. Joshua, thanks so much.
You bet.
And finally, the world's most expensive pigeon, a flying, cooing, racing pigeon. Jeremy, any idea how much it's worth? You want to hazard a guess
pigeon,
here?
$100.
$100. $328,000.
For a pigeon?
For a pigeon. At least that's what a Chinese shipping magnate paid to buy a very fancy racing pigeon. According to the Telegraph of London, pigeon racing is a fast-growing sport in China. But a lot of pigeon lovers aren't happy with today's new high price. Apparently, racing birds isn't traditionally a rich man's hobby. And here in the U.S., you were right. A pigeon might set you back $50 to a couple hundred bucks.
It really says a lot about the Chinese bubble that is going on, that they are paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for a pigeon.
For one, all you one need to fast know. Pigeon.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.